Thanks for joining us on the Cultured Meat and Future Food Show. We're excited to have Dr. Tom Simmons as the guest for today's episode. Most people learn about podcasts from their friends, so please share the link with any friends or colleagues that you think might find this show interesting. I recently attended a Chatham House meeting about plant-based meat and cultured meat with panelists including Guy Poppe, Alexandra Sexton, and Benjamina Bolog. Seeing alternative proteins come up in international discussions is a great step forward for the industry. New Harvest 2019 is taking place on July 19th and 20th at the MIT Media Lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Learn more and register for the event at www.new-harvest.org. The Cultured Meat Symposium is taking place in downtown San Francisco on November 14th and 15th. Learn more and register at www.cms19.com. Tom is the founder and CEO of STEM. He formerly held fellowships at the University of Cambridge and the World Economic Forum, and has advocated for sugar reduction initiatives through Sky News and Channel 4 television appearances. This episode was recorded live on March 18th, 2019. I had a casual conversation with Tom about food technology and the food industry. So let's take a look. We have about 30 minutes set aside to do a deep dive discussion with Dr. Tom Simmons. And Tom Simmons is the founder and CEO of STEM. Now, is it STEM or STEM Sugar?
The company name is STEM.
STEM, yeah. Okay, with an exclamation point.
The logo has one.
Okay, the logo has one. A little bit of background. Tom is the founder and CEO. He formerly had fellowships at the University of Cambridge and at the World Economic Forum, and has advocated sugar reduction initiatives through Sky News and Channel 4 television appearances. And so Sky News is very big in the UK and Europe.
Correct, yeah.
Right,
Is it not here?
I wouldn't say so. It's like the direct TV. I see it as like the direct TV of Europe.
Okay.
So maybe. Do you have direct TV over there?
I don't know what
that you is. Don't? Okay. So I think it's a little bit of both.
It's
so,
a big satellite channel. Yeah.
Satellite. Yeah. So you watch sports on Sky as well.
Sky Sports is a big
Sky
thing.
Sky Sports.
Yeah.
Very big thing. Yeah. So let me do this official. Tom, I would like to welcome you to the Cultured Meat and Future Food Show. You are in San Francisco, we're in Berkeley actually right now, so San Francisco and Bay Area,
yep.
And you guys are originally based in the UK.
Correct.
Whereabouts in the UK are you now?
Cambridge, still there.
Still in Cambridge, okay, yep. Great. So we gave a very brief introduction, but tell us a little bit about your background and what you're currently working on as it relates to future food.
Cool. Okay, yeah, thanks for having me, Alex. So I'll talk about background first, yeah. So I was for like 9 years in academia. I was in University of Edinburgh, did a PhD there. Then I was in Cambridge for like almost 5 years. I did postdoc, then I had a couple of fellowships. So at one point, not so long ago, I was going to be an academic. I was going to be a professor. Like I knew I was going to be a professor. There was like no doubt in my mind. I knew I could do it. And I knew it was what I wanted to do. So it was sort of a done deal. And yeah, so at some point during that whole process, throughout Cambridge mainly, I realized that, like, you know, I wanted to be a professor because I wanted to do impactful, exciting, innovative technologies, wanted to build technologies and do things that would make a difference. And that's still what sort of drives me now, and it's still what drives STEM. But I sort of realized that I can sort of do a lot of that stuff through business, and in many ways, the sort of the applied stuff that I really wanted to do is probably better served through building a business than running a research lab in a university. So, so maybe like halfway through my time in Cambridge, I sort of fell out of love with the idea of being a full-time professor, and got really interested in starting a business. So my whole research was in I was in carbohydrate chemistry, so it's sort of very related to this. But if you'd have asked me, back 3-4 years ago, you say, Tom, you're going to start a business. What are you going to start the business in? You know, food and sugar, you know, would have been up there, but it wouldn't have been an obvious necessary. It'd been sort of a 1 in 3 chance that I'd done something like that. Most of my research was in like renewables, like renewable materials, renewable chemicals, renewable fuels. That was the sort of application area.
So not food specifically?
Not really, no. So it was all plant science, it was all plant carbohydrates, but it was more about like, renewable uses of plant material. That was the big application. You know, biofuels is a massive, massive trend that a lot of money, both in the US and in Europe, got pumped into research labs in universities to do biofuels research and to do renewable material research. And so this sort of area got a lot of money from that. And so a lot of that focus fell onto those sort of areas. But of course, it taught me a lot about stuff that's very relevant to food. And, you know, I would have always had a passion for health. And I got involved in a few sort of outreach things, like as you described, on Channel 4 and on Sky, where I spoke about sugar and carbohydrates in food. And so this sort of connection. And I think actually the sort of the way these things are a bit disparate actually allowed us to do something really innovative with STEM. So, you know, it's a company operating in the food space, but with expertise and scientific background that came from outside the food space. So, you know, 9 years of research in a sort of area that's very related but is like tangential in some ways means that we can approach problems in a different way to how the food industry has approached problems.
Right. And that makes me think a lot of the innovation occurs when somebody is not necessarily focusing on a particular technology, but like you said, an adjacent technology complements it.
Yes.
Right. Yes. And I guess the first example that comes to mind, this might not necessarily be technology in one sector going to another sector, but the surgery for the eyes. What is that called? When you don't need glasses anymore.
Oh, laser eyes?
Yeah, laser. So LASIK. So LASIK eye surgery. I heard that they found out like how that technology works by someone who got into a car accident.
Right.
There was some scar tissue in their eyes.
Right.
And afterwards, they didn't need to wear glasses anymore. And it was crazy, getting into a car accident and then not needing glasses anymore.
Okay.
And then they investigated that technology, and then they came up with LASIK eye surgery.
Oh, okay.
So something that I definitely would... I wear glasses, you wear glasses, yes. But I definitely would not want to have lasers pointing to my eyes.
Or
but...
crash into a, have a car crash or... just to cure that, yeah.
Right, exactly, so...
No, I think that's like an extreme example.
That's an extreme example.
But I think that's right. I think a lot of companies doing deep science-based innovation, if you like, or deep science-based entrepreneurship... I think they probably tend to approach innovation almost a bit too much like how academics do it. With academics, is we want to, you know, the way to solve a problem is to do a really, really, really hard technical breakthrough and, you know, a lot of research effort, a lot of money, a lot of manpower. And really, like, the best businesses are probably not built on things like that. They're built on the, I don't want to say necessarily serendipitous, because I think you can sort of systematize it in a large way, but... Yeah, you want to take a sort of proven technology and adapt it onto something in a way that no one else has seen. That's where you build a business proposition that looks appealing, because it's sort of proven technology and obvious market needs. And the thing is just that no one's connected the two. Not that we need to invent some crazy new technology to solve the problem.
Right, sense? That the insights from one industry apply to these other industries.
Yeah, yeah. So you can see the analogy from what I'm saying about STEM.
Right.
But I think it could apply to a load of places, and I think it could really, really apply to a lot of life science nowadays, because there's sort of, you know, this has been coming for a long time, I think, but life science is really getting to the point where, you know, there's huge sort of advances made to the point where we can do lots of different things, and you know, life science can ultimately be applied to a whole range of different industries, which right now have sort of are completely unaware of it. So, you know, materials, fuels, food, nutraceuticals, things like that. You know, these places, these industries tend to be run by people who aren't super well versed in these areas. And so there's lots of opportunity, I think, to apply for people who do know that stuff to understand the industry and make connections that no one else has seen.
Right. Actually, so I want to touch on that is really kind of the era that we're in. And I'll give another example that's a little bit far off, too.
Mm-hmm.
So the example that I'll give is related to kind of recording technology. So mm-hmm. right now they say, you know, we actually don't have very high quality equipment here. I think everything was put together with like $50 or $60, right? Okay. But the fact that we can actually record or even live stream with $50 to $60 gives us the golden era of recording yeah. or gear for this time.
Sure.
And so I'm going to use that example to pretty much ask you, if someone is getting into life sciences and biotech, mm-hmm. is right now a really good time for it? And I preface because we're seeing a couple different things. So we originally met at Bonneville Labs, and yes. you guys were based out of Bonneville Labs at that time for a short period of time, right?
We were, yeah.
And actually, I tried a sample, a product. Yeah. It was a cookie. Yeah. And it was awesome. But so Bonneville Labs is a great example, a co-working space for biotech. Right now, we're in a WeWork, again, shared spaces. For biotechnology and the sciences, are we in kind of a golden era for that in terms of accessibility and allowing people to conduct experiments or go into a lab?
Yeah, I mean, there's like, is it a golden era? I mean, I guess it's a lot easier now than it would have been 20 years ago. I mean, I can't speak from personal experience. I wasn't there. But yeah, I mean, there's lots of facilities around and... you know, I mean, to give like a trite example, gene sequencing is an obvious thing that the costs are just astronomically lower than they ever were before. So if you want to do anything in that sort of space, like, it's just impossible until fairly recently. Equipment, you know, we have to do a lot of quite heavy engineering process sort of processes. So we need big facilities. And we're fortunate that there's quite a few of these around nowadays, and which there were, you know, fairly recently there wouldn't have been. So yeah, you can definitely do stuff. The infrastructure is around to do stuff that it would not have been possible to do before, and technology that allows you to do things is the price has come down to a point where you can rapidly iterate in a way you couldn't do before.
Yeah. Definitely not as cheap as podcasting, of course.
Correct. Well, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So back to the product, STEM.
Yeah.
Are you guys taking a B2B approach, B2C approach? What will the product be?
Okay.
And will it be available for consumers, or is it more of a B2B approach?
So I'll tell you what. So yeah, we've not even described what the product is yet, have we? So what STEM does is we make ingredients that allow food companies to make solid food products like cookies, cakes, biscuits, chocolates, pastries, donuts, etc., without the negative health effects of sugar, of conventional sugar. So a lot of these products are full of sugar, of course. So there's, you know, global epidemics in diabetes, obesity, heart disease, tooth decay caused by just excessive amounts of sugar being consumed. And so the background towards, so that's sort of what we do. We make ingredients. We want to sell them to the food industry more so than to consumers. Probably that's where the big problem lies more so than home baking, for example. But so the background to this is that the whole food industry wants to get rid, or wants to reduce sugar at least, across the whole, of course, everything that is produced by the food or beverages. And there's been a huge amount of effort to address that problem over many, many decades. And the product of that, huge amount of effort, has been a whole load of ingredients that allow people to replace sugar to some extent. So these are sort of sweeteners, sugar replacements, etc. And that has enabled, so that's been really successful in enabling sugar reduction or complete sugar replacement in drinks. So if you're going to a supermarket now, almost all drinks are either sugar-free or low in sugar.
Or have a sugar-free alternative, right?
Correct. So, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So these things are sort of widely available right now. And but if you go down a bakery aisle, as opposed to like the beverage aisle, bakery's still packed full of sugar. If you go down a candy section, still full of sugar.
Right.
And the reason is that like replacing sugar in drinks is technically easier than replacing it in food. In drinks, sugar is basically just a sweetener. If you find anything that replaces the sweetness of sugar that tastes sweet when you put it on your tongue, you've basically solved the problem for drinks. So like stevia, for example, you taste it on your tongue, it tastes sweet. That sort of solves the problem. You can get rid of sugar, you can add stevia. There's still issues about it being exactly the same taste of sugar, but to a large extent, it solves the problem. In food, however, you've got far more complicated rolls of sugar. So sugar is not just in cake, it's not just a sweetener, it doesn't just make cakes taste sweet. It also makes cakes look like cake and feel like a cake.
Right.
It plays roles in texture, structure, caramelization, crystallization, browning, etc. So in principle, you could add a bit of stevia to a cake mix and you could make the cake mix that tastes sweet, but if you couldn't add stevia and take out the sugar because it would taste, in principle, sweet, but it would not be, it wouldn't look like a cake or feel like a cake because sugar just defines what a cake is as much as what it tastes like.
Right. We don't have Oreos that are zero sugar.
Yeah, and it's part of the same thing. Yeah, exactly. So what we do is, so there's another aspect to this as well. Nowadays, consumers do not want artificial ingredients. They don't want sugar replacements. They want natural ingredients. Okay, so what we do is we take the approach that we think tackles both these issues. So what we do is we make ingredients in which we extract low calorie sugars. We have a biological process for extracting low calorie sugars from plant materials, and then we sort of clean those up, and that's the ingredient ready to go. So the health advantages are this is low calorie, diabetic friendly, etc. So sort of we address the health issues on a sort of on a natural level. This is all plant derived, so we're safe on that level. But also we've got the additional advantage that because our ingredients actually are sugars themselves, they're low calorie sugars, but they are sugars themselves, they're able to behave in solid food in a way that aspartame and stevia, etc. can't. Physically perform like sugar as well. So we think that for the first time we can economically allow the food industry to make cakes, cookies, biscuits, chocolates, donuts without them being, you know, half cane sugar or half beet sugar. We can put our low calorie sugars in there and still have ingredients that look and feel like cakes but without the health downsides.
Interesting. Okay, so it's low calorie sugar.
Yeah.
But at least from the sample that I tried, the taste was all there. Would you say the taste is one-to-one or is it slightly different?
I suppose with all products, it's easy to make a product that, with all ingredients, it's easy to make a product that tastes bad, right? You can overcook something and everything tastes awful.
Right.
So you've got to, you know, that's what we spent a lot of time during Y Combinator doing, making recipes that appeal to people. So, but we can do it. We can make ingredients and we can make products like the cookies you had that people can taste and so can't tell the difference between the ones that are full of sugar, which causes obesity and diabetes, and our low-calorie sugars, which don't.
Interesting. Okay. And so you mentioned Y Combinator.
Yeah.
Let's chat a little bit about that because so your team went through Y Combinator last year, 2018. And, you know, food technology at Y Combinator is somewhat of a new thing. Before they were focused very much on the computer science tech.
Yes.
And so how was Y Combinator for your team? And how do you think that really, do you think other accelerators will start opening up for food tech? We're seeing a couple, but do you think that they're really setting the stage?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are accelerators that do food only now,
right.
And there are startups that do only biotech, and so they do food as well. But Y Combinator is still heavily on software. The majority. We were actually at the alumni demo day yesterday.
Yesterday, yeah. Okay.
So demo day is right now, today.
Right now, yeah, okay. I saw some tweets about it today,
right,
so
yeah.
I thought, okay, maybe it is.
So
happening.
Demo day is happening 6 months. Yeah, we did it 6 months ago, so it's happening right now. Yeah, I mean. And there are some companies on this batch that are doing technology.
Food.
Yeah,
yeah.
So you know, so obviously, like, and I know it's something they're interested in. That the partners are interested in. It's related to the fact that this has become an area of interest to investors in general. You know, it's all, like 10, 20 years ago, food would not have been a sexy thing to invest in at all, and all of a sudden now it really has become that. And there's been a few big success stories, and advances in technology, like what we talked about, have enabled that, and infrastructure, etc. So yeah, I mean, Y Combinator are interested in it, but so are, you know, the whole investment space all of a sudden.
Right. You know, one food company that I saw, at least for me, sparked a lot of interest was RX Bar.
Oh, yeah.
I have a design background, so a big part of their success, I believe, was attributed to like the rebranding and kind of getting out there, simple ingredients. So that's what perked my interest. But But yeah, I think it's interesting to see so many new, or I guess I should say Sand Hill Road, the Silicon Valley VCs,
yeah,
start now putting more and more money into food.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, cool. So when it comes to food regulation, at least for cultured meat,
yeah,
in the US,
yeah,
and around the world, we see that that's a huge hurdle.
Yeah.
When it comes to regulation of the product that you're working on,
yeah,
is that a challenge?
I mean, so it's always a job to be done. Yeah, we fortunately don't have the same issues with cultured meats.
Right.
I mean, these things are completely in different ball games. What we do, you know, we have to go through a standard process with the FDA and different places around the world.
And for the US, does that fall under the GRAS?
Yeah, that's
generally recognized as safe.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, exactly.
And in the UK, do you have something similar?
So Europe has the Novel Food Regulation.
Okay.
EFSA is EFSA, the European sort of equivalent. They just do food, not drugs, but they have their own one. Yeah, and so I mean. Yeah, it's not trivial, but equally, like, yes, it's not in any way near like the same ballpark as cultured meat, because, you know, as much as it's a new, it's something the food industry has not seen before, what we're doing, it's, as I say, it's a sort of a natural product. We take plant material, they are sugars derived from plants and carbohydrate material derived from plants. So, you know, there's a lot of precedent for stuff like that in the human diet. The FDA really has no huge worries about any health risks. So it's really just a sort of formal process that you have to go through.
Right. And so you probably don't need to have someone dedicated full-time, at least at this stage, just to regulation.
Well, we have a guy doing regulation.
Oh, you do? Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. So regulation is...
I mean, yeah, it's an important thing. Like,
yeah.
We've got to get it done, of course. And yeah. Yeah, so yeah, it's a key thing we need to do. So we do it.
Okay. So there is somebody, yeah. So, you know, this is totally outside of food, but there's a story of a friend that was in the cannabis industry.
Okay.
And he was telling me that when regulations were about to open up in Illinois, his team was working on so much paperwork that the legal team drafted up so much paperwork for the regulation of the cannabis stuff that they had to fill an entire van up with just documents.
Right. Wow.
And drive it down to Springfield and drop it there. And there was all these other essentially pallets of the application process.
Wow.
But I can't imagine that for something that is grass, it takes that much paperwork.
What? Is that really vans full?
That sounds
unbelievable.
So the story is, I'm going to have to get the full details from him, but the story is, there was a legal team in New York that was drafting everything up. They flew that pallet of paperwork over to Chicago. He picked it up with a van, drove it down to Springfield.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's a totally different ballgame, though. But
definitely both different ballgame, yeah.
It makes you realize, like, how crazy regulation can be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So, and I'll fact check those numbers with him. So.
Cool.
What is really the next step for your company, and is there a timeline where we might be eating baked goods that have stem products in them?
Yeah. So so we didn't really say it explicitly then, did I? Yeah, we're focusing on baked goods, as you know, cookies, cakes, biscuits. Ultimately, we think we can apply this same approach to sort of the whole food space. So we think we can address almost any solid food product that, as I say, currently it's this untapped market. Currently, it's sugar is the only game in town. Normal cane sugar. We think we can do that, but we're starting on baked goods. We want to be in a food in a US based bakery product this time next year.
Okay. Are you starting with the US first?
Yeah, starting with US first. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Why is that?
Well, we think the market makes more sense.
More donuts being sold, maybe?
Well, Americans eat a lot of bakery. Yeah. Americans eat a lot of sugar. But I mean, demographically, Europe's not a million miles away, but probably America does consume more. And, you know, investors are here. The climate for it seems more relevant here. We're doing regulation here already, so
right,
yeah. So it's sort of all pointing in this direction.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So if there's an entrepreneur out there that's interested in getting into the food technology space, do you have any advice for them?
Getting into the food technology space, I'm actually doing something. I'm the agri-food pathway lead in the Judge Business School in Cambridge right now. So they've asked me to do, like, help them sort of put together some course material for students. And one of the tough things about it is it's like such a diverse area.
Right.
You said food in particular. This is agri-food, but you know, anything from farm all the way to a food product, there's just a million different things within that. So
right.
I can't profess to be an expert in all these different areas. Like, you know, for the area that we're in right now, like, I think the, like, a lot of my sort of reflections on why we've had success with the approach we've taken so far was retrospective realization of it being the right strategy rather than in advance. But it was basically what I said to you before. You know, I think what you want to try and do is avoid as much as possible any, like, having to do incredibly complex technical advances to achieve things. And you want to look for opportunities where science, life science in our case or whatever, has reached a sort of a point where it can be applied in certain spaces and without having to go and get astronomic amounts of money to do groundbreaking breakthroughs on a sort of basic science level. You want to find find places where robust technology solves known problems and the missing piece of the puzzle is only the fact that no one's connected the two.
Right.
Which is sort of what we said before, but it's easier said than done. Like, right. It's pretty tough. The whole point is, like, if it was obvious, someone would have done it already. So the way to do that, I think, is you've got to sort of understand a broader range of technical subjects and really put the effort into understanding what drives industries to have certain problems and consumers to make certain decisions. But that strikes me as by far the better a business proposition. If you can put something like that together, a clear problem and a solution that works, not a clear problem and like, oh, we're going to try and make something to solve it and we need somebody to do that.
Right, yeah. Kind of identifying the problem instead of trying to develop the problem.
Yeah, so. And you know, because a lot of the food industry is, it's not like the pharmaceutical industry where it's run by intense scientists. There are good scientists, of course, in the food industry, but not quite as scientific. So I think there's more space for these sort of things to find a place in this area.
Right. Yeah. That leads on to kind of a fun question I have.
Okay.
I recently. Finally. What's that? Oh yeah. So I recently heard about a science tool, a lab tool, called the mouth pipette. Am I saying it right, Anita? Yes. So have you heard of the mouth pipette?
The mouth pipette?
Yes.
It wasn't that how people used to pipette years ago?
Right.
Right.
Is that a thing? Have you heard of that? Are there history books where people are using this? Like, yeah. To me, that sounds insane.
Yeah,
right?
For sure. People used to use, instead of having a pipette with a, I mean, right. These things are quite complex things. Before right. that, there was like a glass tube and you just sucked and you had to stop sucking at the right point.
What if you get distracted, right?
Yeah.
Of course, you wouldn't get a text and like, oh, right? But...
Yeah, well, that's why they're not used anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's crazy.
No, but I'm pretty sure in some of the labs I've worked in, they had old ones lying around with explicit instruction: do not use those things. Yeah.
Right. Oh, wow. That's crazy. I'm not in the science world, right? And so, have never really been in a lab. So thinking about that is,
well, the things that used to happen, like, you know, a century ago in like chemical research is like insane. People used to smoke next to all the chemicals while they did experiments.
Yeah. Oh no. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Thank you so much. Before we cut off today, I want to reach out to see if there's anybody that has any questions. If we don't have any questions, we can maybe follow up on social media or anything like that. And before we cut off, your team is based in Cambridge right now. Are you guys currently hiring?
Yes, we are hiring right now, yeah.
Okay, and the best place to find job openings and information about your company is stemsugar.com.
Correct, yeah.
STEMsugar.com.
Correct.
Awesome. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex.
This has been great.
Yep.
And thank you for being with us on the Cultured Meat and Future Food Show.